I know. We're running out of things that could go wrong tonight. All right, so it's season 15 of Mention and Dispatches, which just sounds like we've been around forever, but really we get two seasons out of each year, so we're starting our eighth year of podcast here at the Armchair Dragoons, and we have quite the motley cast tonight. Our buddy Cyrano is back. Jim, how have you been?
Well, I'm doing well. Welcome to September.
Yes, welcome to September as we are recording this. It may not be September whenever anybody gets around to listening to it, but that's we hope you've listened to it shortly after we've released it. But if you're finding us 3 years later, welcome. We're happy to have you. Our buddy Gary is back. Aardwolf, how you doing?
Howdy.
And Liz caught something at Gen Con and hasn't shaken it yet, so we're going to try and not have to have her shout over the rest of us. Liz, how are you doing?
I am alive and happy to chat about war games.
All right. To that end, it's a good thing because this is nominally a show about war games. We'll see how far we stay on topic on all of this. But we are going to start with this as the caveat to it all. This is all Liz's fault because so last year when it might have even been the year before when we did the solo wargaming survey and we were doing the wrap up podcast that Liz and I and BB Mike did to talk about the results of that survey, this topic came up. And one of the things that I did this year as we were prepping for the surveys, I went back and listened to the podcasts from the last 2 years because we always make a suggestion in the podcast like, oh, we should make sure we remember to do that next year. And then we always forget because we, you know, we're doing it a year later. And so I was like, you know, there's probably a note in there of, hey, we should remember to do this. This topic came up, the idea of sort of what is that wargaming canon?
Because we don't have like a canon yet either of things that you have to like for, you know what I mean?
Right. If you claim you are a wargamer, what are the things that you should have played? What are the war games that... Not that you have to love them, not necessarily that they are the best war games out there, not that they should be your favorite, but that at some point in your life, you should have slung dice and pushed counters over a couple of particular games if you're going to claim that you're one of the war gamers. And if you are a new war gamer, one of those relatively new converts to the hobby or sort of war game curious, then these are maybe some of the ones that you would like to take a look at some point, if only to provide that common reference point for conversations later with your fellow Grognards.
So since you're blaming me for this, I do want to caveat before we get too far in this episode. I don't actually think there is a real canon or that you have to do anything to call yourself a wargamer other than play war games. But there's often things that I feel like I should play to fill in my own kind of knowledge and context for the hobby. And so this is more like there's no actual pressure to do any of this. This is more about
you're
the pressure we put on ourselves.
There's no way that we can walk around with an air of superiority like the Starbelly Sneeches if we don't force people to conform to our opinions.
I'm gatekeeping the hell out of this. I don't know about y'all. I'm good. Let's do this.
Jim's got a comprehensive list of Kevin Zucker titles that he'll be reading off to us this evening.
Well, right. Oh, well, that's for openers, man. You know that.
Yeah. Jim's just going to start with go to the OSG page and done.
Buy everything and you're all set.
Play everything and then comment.
Yeah. You may not have to buy them all, but at least play them all. You know, you and four friends could each buy one and then you got four games to play. And as Jim likes to point out, you should be playing games with friends because solo gaming isn't real war gaming. Right, Jim?
What?
Well, solo gaming really isn't a thing. You've not heard me rant on this.
Y'all need help. Hey,
in fact, Jim, we have heard
you
rant on this.
Well, I know you have, Gary. But God's sake, man.
I've heard you rant on it for 15 years.
Yeah.
My job title is solo game specialist, so I'll just enjoy my fake job over here.
Well, there are people guarding the American Strategic Helium Reserve, too.
I was going to say, Jim works in politics. He knows
what fake jobs look like. Made up government. Good Lord, madam. That is what we do.
I've been working real hard for a made up job.
Oh, boy. All right. Told y'all that this was going to get off the rails in a hurry. What I'd asked of our panel here was somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 to 7 to 8, maybe total titles, not trying to rank order them necessarily, not trying to put them in a specific sequence, but just if someone wants to be a well-read isn't the right term, but a well-rounded wargamer or wants to sort of understand the breadth and depth of the hobby, what are some of those games that they could have, would have, should have played somewhere along that wargaming journey? And so, look, we can take forever and go around and everybody give us one at a time or whatever. We're gonna start, Gary, give us, you know, maybe two or three off the top of the stack, and we'll see if any of the rest of us have similar ones on there and run the conversation from there.
So I have a list of 15 games, of which Case Blue is the smallest.
So somehow that surprises absolutely no one that has heard more than one and a half of your shows.
How about that? Yeah. No, I went out of my way to only have one monster game, because I do think that folks should try to play a monster game. Maybe it won't be for them, right? No, it doesn't really matter which one necessarily. I think it's a key, I don't want to say it's a key experience, right? Because not everybody does it. Not everybody practically can accomplish playing a monster game, right? There are huge challenges to playing monster games. So I decided to not choose any of the Europa games, and I picked War in Europe instead as a definitive epic monster gaming experience.
Surprised it's not an OCS one. So we got a monster game on there, of which you've picked War in Europe as kind of the exemplar.
Well, for a couple of reasons. One, it's a classic, right? It came out in 75, 76, something like that. And it's enormous. You don't have to play the entire thing, but it's also relatively straightforward, unlike a number of other monster games I might mention. It's relatively easy to play, and yet it has richness and depth in it. Not to say that it is absolutely airtight, it is not. But it's a tremendous experience to just play, you know, that huge game and kind of see these huge epic movements sweeping forward. Like an OCS game actually feels a little different to me than like a large Europa game or something like War in Europe. I'm not really positive I can put my finger on why. It could be simply that the OCS mechanics are more modern, meaning the 90s, which is, you know, modern for wargaming, than the 70s mechanics of War in Europe. But that was what I landed on. If somebody's going to play a monster game, that's a pretty good one to pick. And hey, they played it at Historicon, at least a little bit of it at Historicon this year.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, and this is probably a good topic for another show, is that there are varying types of monster games. On one hand, you have some that are just big. Like, they're not overly complicated. They may not even be all that particularly deep in the kinds of things they're exploring, but there's just a crap ton to it, right? There's 11 map sheets and 2,600 counters or whatever, and like 8 pages of rules, but there's just a ton of crap on the table. And then there are the super granular, occasionally esoteric and off the wall, and, you know, you put that rule in there as a joke, didn't you, kinds of games, you know, that are rather enormous. I could see War in Europe certainly fitting the bill as you know, a monster, kind of an approachable monster game, but to give you that monster game experience. Mm-hmm. What else do you have toward the top end of the list there or somewhere up there?
I think everybody should play a Kriegspiel at least once. Not the Avalon Hill Kriegspiel, that's a turd. I mean, an actual, you know, Kriegspiel run by a referee with potentially a large number of players and tons of hidden information. I think it's a tremendously illuminating experience that everybody who considers themselves a wargamer ought to do at least once. They don't have to like it, but I think it will be an educational experience for any wargamer to play a game like that. And there are other examples, too, that are maybe a little bit more familiar. There's the old GDW line of double blind games, for example, which kind of does something similar, sort of. You can play Flat Top, which kind of simulates being double blind with the fact that you've got to do a lot of paperwork.
Yeah.
But that, to me, that was a very illuminating experience, was playing the Kriegspiel with the Dragoons at, actually, I'm not 100% sure it was Dragoons at the time. It may even have been back in the Grogheads days. But I thought that was a tremendously enriching experience to play it.
Yeah.
Everything else I have on the list is relatively pedestrian, I got to tell you.
At this point, Jim's got a mile-wide smile on his face, and he's happy. Like, somebody mentioned Kriegspiel, he's good.
Well, I haven't even. Really, let me get to. What's that, Liz?
I would really like to play Queer Creek Spiel. I've had a chance, and it was like everybody got kind of sick or canceled, and it was bad. I'm going to take my next shot.
I think I remember that because I think I was in one of the ones that Jan Heinemann was setting up.
Yeah.
And it just like fell apart because a bunch of people couldn't do it at more or less the last minute.
You know, if you would show up for Origins instead of your college roommate's wedding, you would have had a chance to play in two or three.
Yes, well.
I'm just saying.
You're just going to have to keep waiting on Origins. My con budget is full.
You got wait a minute. You have that. That's a professional junket for you now. You should have your employer pay for the entire trip.
If they do that, they're going to want her to like work the booth.
This is
going to
turn into a tariff conversation if we go too much further down the road, and we don't want that tonight.
That's fair. I don't want to talk about that either.
Okay, Jim, toward the top of your list, what are the top like two, maybe three things you've got toward the top of your list there? And why do they all involve a short course of it?
Well, number one, as I'm sitting here, and nobody can see this, but if you're looking at this in the StreamYard we used to record, I've got Von Reisfitz as my avatar. So, of course, I was going to mention a Kriegspiel. Big thumbs up to Gary for that one. Liz, you are formally invited to the next email Kriegspiel I fire up. We're currently making our way through 1815. There will be another. I will invite you.
Yes.
And the nice thing about that is the time commitment is probably about 10 minutes a day or something like that.
Hold on. Liz thinks this is a great thing. You're saying it's only 10 minutes a day. The part you're neglecting is it's 10 minutes a day for the next 22 months of your life.
Okay, yes. Look, I'll be real. I've been playing Virgin Queen on Monday nights for weeks now, and I don't have a problem. So I can
do 10 minutes. Ooh, X-Heat. There you go.
War in Europe coming up.
War in Europe, table two. Yeah, but no, I definitely, and everything that Gary said is exactly right. I would put, now personally, I'd put the 1824 on there myself, just because when well run, and despite all the teasing I give him, Dr. Sterrett does a pretty good job of managing it, but really learning where a lot of those ideas come from that both inform our tabletop hex encounter games and our miniature games, it feeds so much. And frankly, it becomes the inspiration for Dungeons and Dragons and RPGs and a whole bunch of other stuff down the road, too. That's where Gary Gygax and the others got the idea for an umpired game, was from the Kriegspiel. So it informs so much of our hobby that it's kind of silly not to have it on the list somewhere.
Are you going to insist that they do it in German?
It's probably best, you know, if it can possibly be managed to do that in German. In terms of a big battle, in terms of the kind of big stuff that Gary's talking about, I really struggled with this because I really did want it to be a, hey, go check out this corner of the hobby. You know, go see what this thing would be like. And I tried to stay away from the most arcane things that I have. But I don't know as I would be me if I didn't say Empires in Arms. And I get it. It's not going to be for everybody. And there are some people who are going to bounce off it so hard you're going to hear the sound in the next county. But watching it played and seeing those mechanics and looking at that, it's one of the most detailed strategic simulations I can think of in any period.
Yeah.
It's another one of those games, too, that is a singular experience. I don't know that there's a whole lot else out there like Empires in Arms.
Right. And it is such, you know, it informs so much else of the way we think about it. So many other games have been released in the Napoleonic and other spaces that have always struck me as a reaction. Well, it's not Empires in Arms. Come on, you know. It's one of those that I would say to people, go check it out, look at it, watch it played, experience the play of it, no matter what your particular experience of it would be, I should say. It sounds like we're going to wander into some more mundane and perhaps obvious choices, but yeah, my two top line ones would be a Kriegspiel, particularly the 1824 and Empires in Arms.
All right, cool. Liz, what's up at the top of your list?
Ooh, okay, so I had a hard time with these lists, possibly because I put it off till today and then I had a fever earlier today, so it's like a fever dream list, but also because I think there are the things that I feel like I'm supposed to play, and then there are things that I actually feel have been foundational for me in real life.
Okay.
And so I also think that, you know, you can mention as many specific games as you want, but I think for me this actually comes down to categories. So for me, I feel like, for example, like this is my sort of what I think other people think is the canon list. Does that make sense? I think that you should play some kind of early Hex Encounter game. So I put D-Day on here because if you want to know like all the way back to the beginning, you got to pick one of those early Hex Encounters. But I think a Hex Encounter game obviously has to be on the war game canon list.
You're talking about the old Avalon Hill D-Day.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that is the first war game with hexes on it too, yes. At least commercially produced.
So for me, like, I think that, you know, if you want to try it, it's on Vassal. Like, you should go check it out. I think that you need a block game.
Okay.
So a Hammer of the Scots or, like, a Commands and Colors, because it'll introduce you, right, to, like, another aspect of the hobby. To me, I think Coin has been so foundational that you need to play a Coin game. Cuba Libre is, like, the first one, so it's, like, a good place to start. It's also still one of the simplest
Actually,
ones.
Cuba Libre was the second. The first one was Andy and Abyss.
Oh, yeah, you're right. But it's Cuba Libre is the most accessible one still, I think.
It is more accessible than the others.
You can make an argument for People Power, but I think that it's actually a little too imbalanced feeling if you don't know what you're doing, because the government can run away with it, and it's only three people. So I think Cuba Libre is still the best.
I think Cuba Libre is a great starting point, because everybody is, it's one of the most well-balanced in terms of all four factions, being well-balanced and being able to act more or less independently of the others, which is not true of many of the coin games. But also because it's a fairly small footprint, it goes pretty quick. It moves fast. There's not a lot of sitting around biding your time waiting for something to happen. Like, you're right in the action.
Yeah. And as a solo player, especially, I think that you should play a States of Siege game. Frankly, the best one, I think, is probably still the zombie one. Yeah. So, like, I don't know that, like, you know
they're bringing that one back, right?
Yes, but I'm happy with my schmancy third edition copy. So we'll see if I want to. We'll see how I feel about the next bit. I think that, you know, you should try one of them. So you could do something like Ottoman Sunset. You can do, like, there's a lot of different options. But I think a States of Siege game is good to play because, again, that system informs so many other systems. So if you're looking for, like, core wargame experiences, I kind of feel like those categories are good. If you want to stretch into historical gaming, which I like to, I think you should play a PAX game and not one of the later ones from Ion. You need to go play a Phil Eklund, or you need to go play PAX Premier.
Okay.
That's
Yeah. I mean, I know when I was thinking of the list, I was also thinking of some particular categories. There were a couple of them. We'll get to a couple of mine here in a second. There were a couple of them that I had, you know, kind of at the top of the list that it's this specific thing. But then I was thinking about some different categories similar to what you did. I'll respond to a couple of your ideas here in a second. I also had a Kriegsspiel on my list, that a true multiplayer, double blind, refereed, There's a truly free Kriegsspiel, and then there are very straight-jacketed Kriegsspiels, and then there's all sorts of hybrids in between in terms of adjudication. But the idea of all you've got is this little corner of the world that you can see, and, you know, with your horse blinders on, and the only reports you get are those that are relayed to you by the umpire crew, and you're making the best decisions you can within imperfect information. And if you really want to mess with folks, you put a tight timer on them as well.
Yeah,
which you'll never get with Jim's email stuff, because he gives you a week. He gives you 6 days to ignore it and 1 day to panic in terms of getting your stuff back in. But the put a pretty tight timer on your players also, and watch the lack of perfect knowledge plus time pressure really get to them. You'll really start to see the steam coming out their ears. But I definitely had a Kriegsspiel up there fairly high. And then one of the other things that I had looked at was in terms of, hey, you should probably have played at least one of these somewhere along the way. You'd mentioned D-Day in terms of the early Hex Encounter ones. I was thinking more broadly across the early Avalon Hill flat box games, not the bookcase games. D-Day, Blitzkrieg, Africa Corps, Chambersville. Gary, Jim, help me out. What are some of the other titles that I should be thinking in that early flat box?
Stalingrad, Tactics.
It's at some point somebody's mentioning Waterloo or going to punch somebody in the knee.
Waterloo, there's Gettysburg too, any of the 75 different editions of it that Avalon
right.
did.
Yeah.
The caveat here is I would not put War at Sea or Victory in the Pacific in those categories, because I do think those are pretty different games. in that whole area.
Those are mid-70s, too, as I recall.
Yeah, those are a little later. But they had, I wanted to throw that caveat out in case somebody's just kind of looking at what are the things that were in these size and shape boxes. I'm talking about some of those really old, original, foundational Avalon Hill flat box games. And they weren't all hex encounter. They were all counter. Tactics had a square grid instead of a hex grid. And I think Chancellorsville did, too. Gettysburg, I'm pretty sure, was still squares.
The first, I think, two versions of Gettysburg that Avalon Hill did were squares. The third one was hexes. I think they went back to squares. And then they're all pretty different games, to be honest, though.
I will say, so one that I had considered and then discarded, I was going to put diplomacy on my list. And I pulled it back off for two reasons. One, I think there's a whole world of diplomacy that exists outside of wargaming that as neat of an experience as it is, I'm not sure it's necessarily a part of the wargaming canon. But I also think that it's not that it's too close to Kriegsspiel, but it's a little more of that personal interaction stuff that you can get. You can scratch that itch in a lot of other games in a lot of other ways that you don't have to do it with diplomacy and still get a pretty good wargaming experience out of it. There's a lot of interpersonal dynamics in the coin games, for instance, that I didn't feel like diplomacy had to be on the list.
Yeah.
Is something that I would have thrown out there. So those were right up toward the top of mine were a Kriegsspiel and then one of those older flat box Avalon Hill, very early games like Waterloo or Stalingrad or, you know, D-Day, as Liz mentioned earlier. And I know one of the challenges I had, and Jim, Gary, I don't know if this was something that you also had too, is that some of the games that were very important to me in my journey as a wargamer from when I was a ute way back when, you know, learning to play with dad kind of stuff, are not necessarily ones that I think would belong in the wargaming canon to everyone else, even though they were very formative for me. That's just, I'm not sure that as much as I loved growing up playing a bunch of those Cold War Goes Hot mid-70s games from SPI, that those necessarily belong in the canon, even though they were important to me. So that was something that I did struggle with in all of this. Gary, what else you got?
Empire of the Sun. I think it is a good representative of a CDG. It also has the added benefit, in my opinion, of being a Hex Encounter CDG. And it's just a terrific game. And it puts the Pacific War in there, which I think is undergamed by a lot of wargamers.
Okay. What else? What's another one after that on the list there?
Wooden Ships and Iron Men. Mid to late 70s Avalon Hill. Classic game, still holds up just as well today as it did back in the day. I mean, it's a little fussy. There's a bit of paperwork. Not everybody's going to like it, but it is representative of a certain type of war game that I think people ought to experience if they, you know, want to strut as wargamers.
Do we strut, or do we just kind of like hunch over boards holding tweezers?
Mine is more of a waddle than a strut, to be fair.
Well, and the nice thing with Wooden Ships and Iron Men is because they're all double-length ship counters except for the gunboats, you don't really need the tweezers.
That's true. You don't need tweezers. You don't need tweezers for Empire of the Sun either. You can also play it with almost no effort with miniatures, too.
Yes. Yes. And what's interesting is if you've ever got a bunch of Battletech players, you want to get into historical gaming, put Wooden Ships and Iron Men in front of them first, because all those ship tracking sheets, they will know exactly what to do with them.
Yep. Or Starfleet Battles People.
Also true. I was around a lot more Battletech people growing up than Starfleet Battles people. But yeah, you can put Wooden Ships and Iron Men in front of them and they will know exactly what's going on because of those ship tracking sheets. Those were the birth of Battletech tracking sheets. I swear they absolutely were. So
I want to point out, Gary, I'm really glad that you brought up CDGs because that's another category I think is important. I like other CDGs that I've played, but stuff like Here I Stand and Virgin Queen has really been like a big part of my life recently, and I'm feeling it.
I could see that as like an additional category that a representative of would be a good idea to play. Yeah. Virgin Queen, Tantomanta, Here I Stand. I would throw Napoleonic Wars in there, for example. Jim will like that. It's a terrific perfect game on its own anyway.
If Liz goes to the mat for Tantomanta, she's going to get kicked out of the Homo Ludens Discord.
Oh, I haven't played Tantomanta, so I can't actually comment.
Yeah, I have not either.
Nor have I.
Interestingly, for whatever reason, I have no idea how this happened. So this past summer at Origins, you know, we've got the big prize table with all the raffle stuff that we give away at the end of the convention. Everybody that plays a game with us gets a raffle ticket for each game you played with us, and you get to sort of pick the games you're trying to win. We had a copy of Virgin Queen in the raffle. And that copy one that GMT had previously sent to us in one of the review boxes for the site. None of the writers wanted to pick it up, and so I went ahead and threw it in the raffle. This is what I do with stuff that the publishers will send to us, but doesn't end up, you know, none of the writers end up grabbing it to run with it. We'll use it as a prize, as a giveaway somewhere along the way. So we can get it out to some gamer somewhere. So this thing sat in my office for the better part of like 7-8 months, whatever. None of the writers were interested, threw it in a raffle. For whatever reason, at Origins, at the raffle, suddenly my daughter really, really, really wants a copy of Virgin Queen.
This I will also point out Virgin Queen is a
7 months. Like, what the hell?
You know what? You're just ready when you're ready. I will point out that Virgin Queen is also the subject of the finest unboxing ever filmed.
Oh boy.
On the Hello Gregor channel. Truly, I never need to watch another unboxing. That one is a true masterclass in unboxing. Just go have fun, kids. Right. If you haven't seen it already.
We'll have to link it to this episode then. But anyway, it's not like I could pull it back out of the raffle for McKenna at that point, because like tickets had already gone into the cups for it at this point. GMT ended up hooking us up with an extra copy for my daughter. So one of our things this summer was going to be to get it out and play it. And then she went to California for 3 weeks and was in drama camp for 3 weeks. So now it's our fall semester project to at some point get out Virgin Queen and learn to play it and push pieces around and whatever.
Yeah, make sure you get some more people over, because it is not a two-player game.
No.
Well, no, I know it's not a two-player game, but we're going to have to do a little bit of two-player exploration of the basic mechanics
before
we can try to bring anybody else into the game, because I need to make sure she understands enough of it that when she's got somebody else in the game with us, it doesn't feel like she's just making it up as she goes.
Yes. Do not give her Spain for her first game. I was giving Spain for my first game. It's been insane. I didn't get good at playing Virgin Queen until somebody let me play the Papacy, and here I stand. And I had like a much smaller set of territories to worry about, so I could actually learn how to do all the land battles, the stacking, without having to worry about a huge empire and start on a smaller one.
we'll see what we come up with. All right, Jim, what else you got on the list, man?
When you first asked about this, my reaction was sort of comparing. If you do history academically, one of the things that they will make you do, whether you like it or not, is this thing called historiography, mm-hmm. which is the history of history. You know, and it's the history of how people have written history. And you go back and you do this and you study it, not just because it's valuable in and of itself, but because it teaches you what the arguments have been, what the conversations have been. And when you look at wargaming today, however you define it, I think it's really, really illuminating to look back and see where you've come from, and to see, because so many games are ultimately conversations with old games. You know, these too many gamers are out there. There are people now designing games who are raised on an entirely different set of games, and they're influenced by it.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
if you're a semi-deity like Mark Herman, of course, your life spans the great arc of gaming and you move on. But that not all of us are ascended humans in that way. It is with that in mind that the next two I proffer, and I'm probably going to be accused of hitting the bunny here, but it's Squad Leader.
Oh, I put that as something. I put Advanced Squad Leader down. I was like, I haven't played it, and I feel like I need to in order to be a complete
gamer. I do not believe you have to play Advanced Squad Leader to be a gamer. Play Squad Leader. I prefer Squad Leader anyway. I'm at peace with that. Not because it's a better game system. I don't care enough about it to get into that. But because what John Hill was trying to do was so important, I think, in the history of gaming. The way he was trying to make World War II squad level combat narrative.
Yeah.
And trying to share that in the vehicle of a lovely set of maps for their time. I mean, Gary's better at this than I am, but my impression always has been that set of graphics was well ahead of its time.
Yeah. I think Gary is currently broadcasting live from the Jelly Belly Factory.
It seems so.
That might be the case. Speaking of, Jim mentioned, though, that a lot of modern games are conversations or responses to older games, which is why another thing that's on my list is Third Reich, the original Avalon Hill Third Reich, which is substantially simpler to play than many of the games that followed up on it. And it doesn't even necessarily take that long. You play that in a couple days, I think, if you know what you're doing.
You could get, I don't know that you could start in 39 and get all the way to 45 with a full five-player game, but you could get a pretty good ways into it in one long afternoon. Start around lunch, finish a little after dinner. If you, got, you already know the rules, you get most of the way through a Third Reich game in an afternoon in a five-player game.
Yeah, and you are in no sense constrained to playing at five players either.
No, no. But
unlike, I mean, that, say, Here I Stand, where you really want the six.
Yeah, yeah, well, but, you know, now that you've said that, I was thinking this whole time as you've been talking about one of my favorite games, Here I Stand. I always say two things about Here I Stand. Number one, it's got a lot of simple pieces, but it's got a lot of them. Did I mention it has a lot? You know, it's got a lot of simple mechanics, but it's got a bunch of them. And that's what confuses most people in my experience. But the other thing I observe about Here I Stand is that game gets joy when you add more people to it. Third Reich brings suffering when you add more people to it. I would not. Yeah, Third Reich, absolutely. But my other one in that sort of, what do I want to say, that historical list to say, look, this is where we come from, and I want you to see what this becomes, just like Squad Leader to me, any one of the Mark Herman introductory quads from SPI. Probably the Blue and the Gray.
Okay.
Is because everybody loves, who don't love the Civil War? I mean, yes.
This
yes,
guy. Yeah,
there is a Napoleonic version of them. And of course, my favorite is actually not Napoleonic. It's the 30 Years' War.
You know, if you'd come to Buckeye Game Fest, we were playing them.
I know you were.
That's true.
David Foster and I were battling out over Rocroi there. So, I mean,
yeah. Those quads were designed, and you know, I've heard Mark speak about this, and he's not the only designer. There's quite a few, but his Blue and the Gray are the central pieces. They're all about simple, accessible, and I know this horrifies some historical gamers, balanced. Most of them were intended to be balanced, whether you succeeded or not, I'll let history judge. But they were also very cheap, actually. They were very simple designs, simple graphics. They were intended to be entry-level games at the time.
Yeah.
And they remain
entry-level games today.
Right. They remain. And we joke about this because we have played on my own channel. We've played all the Civil War quads. We've played the 30 Years War quad twice. We've played both the Napoleonic quads twice. And we always joke. It's the standard joke of, well, that's the rules. And it's typically 2 to 3 pages of actual rules.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
when we set up podcasts with EGF,
we blocked them all off at 3 hours. And I don't think any of them went the full 3 hours. And that included learning the rules.
And explaining that and showing that to people, why SPI was doing that, why Mark and the others were trying to do that, and what that looked like aesthetically. And as much as anything, to inculcate the idea into contemporary gamers, not all games are that, you know, you think about war games as these ultra complex mechanisms. Not all of them are that way. They're just not.
I've been
not.
Saying that for years.
You know, and it's just, they're just not. Look at this. Hold it in your hands and play it and tell me how hard it is. It's just not.
Yeah. Jim's heard my rant enough times about people who joke about war game complexity, right? I never, ever want to hear a single role player say, I can't handle war games. Those things are too complex with our 24-page rule book. And then they pick up a backpack full of hardcovers, you know, and they walk out of there with 700 pages worth of rules in their bag. You know, it's like, just kiss off, man.
I've been saying that for years, too. The monster book for the new edition of Adventures Dark and Deep is like 800 pages. It is crazy.
Oh, Lord.
It was ridiculous. I had Squad Leader and Third Reich both on my list. The other Avalon Hill bookcase thing that I had on my list was one of the Panzer Leader, Panzer Blitz, Arab-Israeli Wars series.
That's a good call.
Again, you may not like them, and there are definitely some things in there to not like, but it is a design that, by and large, has stood the test of time. There is huge amounts of aftermarket support that you can find online for these because they have had had such a huge fan base for the last 50 years. And yeah, we're up to 50 years at this point. But they do for tank combat what Squad Leader did for infantry combat, more or less. The morale rules are not as important, but the idea of this platoon level, very tactical maneuver that allows you to fight the close battle in a huge array of different kinds of conflicts, I think is one of those things that folks should take a look at and explore somewhere in there. And, you know, whether you prefer Panzerblitz, Panzerleader, Arab-Israeli Wars based on whatever conflict appeals more to you, it's the same underlying core rule set. So just, you know, run with that.
So one thing I want to note is I feel like, yeah, my early instincts about this list were right. This is that we're talking a lot about there are certain kinds of games or core rule sets or series. And within that, you should just pick what you're actually attracted to, historically speaking.
Yeah. And I think so. You know, I was thinking coin games also, that you should have a coin game on there somewhere. I was not going to get overly prescriptive as to which one, because after you get to about the sixth one, like I've kind of not played any of the more recent ones. The first five I played a lot of, but the everything after that, not as much.
Can I bring up a topic that will annoy Jim because it's not a real category?
Oh, boy.
Which is that I also think that you do need to... I because I'm a solo gamer, I do think that there's like a slightly different canon, I guess, of like solo war games. And I just want to make sure like somebody gives it some attention. And then maybe we'll get some more in the comments. But when I think about solo wargaming in particular, I think that we have to talk about Ambush and all those kind of like story generating games. You know, you've got things like Thunderbolt Apache Leader, but you also have lots of like B-17 Queen of the Skies or like Target for Today, Target for Tonight. Like you've got these kind of like story generating games where you're rolling and like seeing what happens on a chart.
It's like choose your own adventure games.
Yes. I think that even if you don't like them, I think that they are a key enough part of our community that they're worth engaging with and trying to understand. And I do think that you should play some sort of John Butterfield something like RAF Battle of Britain, for example, would be a great idea, or like Enemy Action Ardennes. Like I think that I just want to, like, there's a lot of other things we could talk about, but this is not a solo show. I just want to point out there's like a lot of interesting stuff kind of over in that corner of wargaming. I mean, wargamers are the original solo gamers because people just play all sides, but there's also some solo specific stuff that is so cool.
Yeah, we're gonna have a whole podcast coming up on the results of the solo wargame survey that, as we are recording, is still open and ongoing, but we will, you know, we'll probably have the results about the time this podcast goes live for the public to listen to. So
yes,
the wrap up episode will be, you know, two or three episodes from now, where we'll take a look at the results, and we can definitely talk about sort of the solo wargaming canon at that point.
Oh yes,
and Jim will make sure he skips that episode. So we'll be cool.
Tempted to skip it, I'm inserting it here. Also, just go play D-Day at Omaha Beach. Apparently, that's the communal decision. We'll see how it goes this year.
I'm the guy that got D-Day Dice, the all-in thing with the bag and everything, and refused to play it solo. I got friends, and we sat down and played.
You're such a dork. That game slaps. You should just play it.
I have friends.
Oh, so do I. I just
Well, also... then invite them over and play games with them. But
I do, but solo gaming is its own thing.
And it's funny because I adore Ambush. I have all of it. It's sitting on my shelf right here. And to well, this is a whole different conversation, but to me, Ambush is something of a cul-de-sac. It came, it was brilliant, and then they tried to do a stupid multiplayer version of it, and it just kind of ended. I don't even know where the spirit of the genius of that game lives anymore. But I will tell you, when I played Ambush, I always played it with friends. We played it as a sort of a RPG without an umpire.
It's a co-op game at that point.
Yep.
Season 15 of Mentioned in Dispatches is graciously supported by all of our Patreon members, but especially our regimental patrons who supported us at the top level. The Armchair Dragoons would like to thank Miles R., James M., Kevin Bertram, Catastrophe Games, Fred and his dog, Joseph Knorr, Patrick Geraghty, Michael Sunborg, Stagger Wing, and Paul LaFontaine. Wargaming is our jam, and they help us spread it. You too can support the Regiment of Strategy Gaming as a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
Jim, what else do you have on the list there? You've only gone for like one or two Napoleonic anythings at this point.
Well, no, and I think Liz's point is exactly right, is that it's really more about types of games and sort of the way that gaming has evolved and the way it has changed, the way this hobby that we all share and love has been changed. The biggest interface of the past 15 years has been this, you know, we were all sitting there minding our own business, looking at our grubby little sheets of paper, pencils, grease, paint, and whatever else we were doing. And all of a sudden, like the Kool-Aid man crashing through the wall, came the Eurogamers and the board gamers. And they really fundamentally changed the way a lot of people think about war games. And I would put side by side, I don't regard, for example, a game I love, Commands and Colors, that whole series, as a block game. It uses blocks, but it's not a block game in the same sense that Napoleon is, which uses the block as mechanic and concealment and all those other things. But what I would definitely have somebody do, and here I do get to mention a Napoleonic game, I would have them grab, because it's just the latest edition, even though it's much older, Napoleon, Columbia Games, block game. The fourth edition is lovely and really, really cool. But then I would set it right next to Shacko's 1815 and see how, you know, this genius of Tom Douglas over in the Columbia space has now been elevated even further, not diminishing it, just been elevated by this input of Euro mechanics, Euro aesthetics. It looks like a Euro game, yeah. And it's a fascinating thing. I have them both. I sit them side by side and I look at them. And also, let's not fool ourselves. They have pushed the ball forward down the field in terms of making games have cooler parts.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Go back to the Halcyon 5. I had a glorious time in the 80s and 90s playing SPI and Avalon Hill games. None of them had those cool rubberized mats that filled up an entire dining room table.
Yeah.
Didn't have any of that. We had cardboard and paper and stuff. So being able to show someone and say, do you see how this has changed? Do you see the way this hobby has altered in this amazing way? And then, of course, and this, I think, I don't know. I don't have a good handle on this. I think this has shrunk a bit just because the market has changed the way it is. But we had a brief time when we thought we were actually going to get plastic minis in all our games. You know, we had games like Tide of Iron and things like that. I can't think of a game I would really recommend like that, but I've got a couple of Napoleonic games that tried it and stuff like that. But the main piece for me is showing how the Euro aesthetic, the board game aesthetic, influenced the hobby. And a great example to me to show that would be Napoleon and Shacko's. Really any of the Shacko's games, but since it's the same campaign, Shacko's 1815.
Yeah. I can't tell you anything about any of the Shacko stuff other than that Jim highly recommends them. But I can vouch for the Columbia block games, which are, you know, kind of the archetypical block games because it was Columbia Games as Gamma 2 that came up with the idea in the first place.
Yeah. And that's for folks that, so Liz mentioned Hammer of the Scots earlier, Julius Caesar, Texas Glory, Quebec. What's the year?
1759.
I was going to say 1754, and I knew that wasn't right, but I couldn't remember what the right answer was. So there are a bunch of the Columbia games. Worthington has a bunch of games using a very similar block mechanic where it's fog of war, but the block is also your step counter in terms of how many steps your unit has. And so Worthington has a whole bunch of the games in that series, mostly American Revolution, but there's a couple of Civil War ones floating around out there. The guys from Vento Nuovo over in Italy use a block mechanic. They have depending on the game, they've got some very different combat systems, some of them diceless, but they've got a set of those block games as well. Jim, you mentioned kind of the getting the minis within the game. I think that's something that you saw with a lot of the mass market ones, because minis are cool, they look good on the table, and grandma's going to buy cool looking toys for the 12-year-old, you know, grandson for Christmas. Battle Cry was one of the first very popular ones to do that. Memoir 44's got them. Battle Lore had them. So there's a bunch of those in the Commands and Colors realm, but you're right. I would definitely separate Commands and Colors series games that happen to have blocks from block games where the fog of war actually matters. And you know, you could replace the blocks in Commands and Colors Napoleonics or Commands and Colors Ancients with minis and play the exact same game.
You literally can, because it's called Memoir 44. It's just the World War II version, and it's got little minis.
Yeah. But to that end, I would put a Commands and Colors game on that canon list somewhere, where, you know, like we've said in a couple of other cases where it's similar mechanics, different, you know, different theaters of war, different eras of war. You know, if you're interested in Napoleonics, great, do that. If you'd rather big stompy elephants, fine, go play Ancients. If you want World War II, play Memoir 44. But there's a Commands and Colors game for darn near any field of combat you want, including now Star Wars, because there's the new Hoth game that's out. I don't know that there was ever a Cold War Goes Hot Commands and Colors game, but that's about the only thing I can think of that there wasn't one of.
Well, our guy Fidelis, who hangs around the Dragoons, he plays in the same hobby store where Richard Borg does. It would not surprise me in the least if Richard didn't have a Cold War Goes Hot, because he has literally everything else in folder somewhere, just trying to find a publisher.
Maybe we can get him to bring one of those up to the Fall Assembly, because
I have been astonished at the array of things that he has Commands and Colors worked out for.
Yeah,
you know, I guess it goes to your point. It's a system that has been used very successfully in periods ranging from antiquity to the far future.
Yeah, because there's a Space Armada battles game in the Commands and Colors series also.
Red Alert, is that what
Red
it's called?
Red Alert, exactly.
Yeah, I couldn't remember what it was called, so I was trying to not
which regrettably launched without an IP, and I think that cost it, but that's the nature of that beast.
Well, now that we have a Star Wars game in the CNC series, maybe we'll see some more. Who knows? Gary, what else have you got on the rest of the list that we hadn't got to yet?
Frederick the Great.
Yay.
Classic SPI title for the 74, something like that, plus or minus a year. Maybe 76, actually. Frank Davis design. Was really not introduced to it myself until like 2 years ago, and it's really, really slick.
Yeah.
It's a really tight game. Now, there isn't, oddly, a campaign game in the box. It's all scenarios, but some of the scenarios are reasonably chewy, while not necessarily taking you more than a couple hours to play. There is a campaign game that was released in the general, and I have that, but I haven't tried it. My suspicion and fear is that it might work exactly as well as the War and Peace campaign game.
That good.
Yeah, that's War and Peace is a wonderful game. And, you know, it was one that I thought about for this list. But I think the campaign just doesn't work. Even in the new OSS edition, there's a new 7th edition that's going to get kickstarted anytime soon now. Apparently, there's one every other year now.
No. So the 7th edition is out. It's the second printing that is on pre-order right now.
You'll forgive me for losing track of exactly how many editions of War and Peace 7th edition there are.
I get it. There have been as many editions of War and Peace as there were farewell tours by The Who. So I get it.
I love Mark McLaughlin.
Oh,
I love Napoleonic Wars, which is his. Hey, mm-hmm. We love it. Get War and Peace. Get the later edition. Play the scenarios. They're awesome. Give up all hope of ever playing the Grand Campaign. It has never worked. I don't believe it ever will work, at least not within the framework of the Heat Death of the Sun.
I think 5 or 6 player War and Peace game from, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, something like that. We tried it, man. It fell apart before the end of 1806.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No. I was young. Jim was shattered in 1984. I want to say, when my friends that I had roped into playing with this, do you know what kind of begging it takes? You know, y'all are spoiled. You kids are spoiled. You know what it takes to get guys.
Don't make me put my pants on.
Do not make me put my pants on. Do you know what it takes to get your friends to play a multiplayer board game in 1984? Do you?
Yes, I'm tired actually. Of this, Grandpa.
Yeah, I see. I'm telling you.
This sucks, Granddad.
And I did. Yeah. Jesus, Grandpa, why did you tell me this story? You know, and they all went, this game doesn't work. And I wanted them to be wrong. And when I realized they were right, I was shattered.
Yeah.
And no, it does not work. So go out. War and Peace is great. But just that reference got me. You got me. But can I say, since you said Frederick the Great, and since we were talking about Euros, go play Maria.
I need to play that so bad. David Thompson has been on me about playing it. It's got to happen.
I'd like to try that too.
I'm going
to
message him now. But
Sebastian Bay has a near pornographic relationship with that game.
So correct me if I'm wrong. Well, I guess it works either way. Oh, and Frederick, I guess, too, right?
And Frederick. Yeah, he prefers Maria. I have them both. I think they're both grand. I'll play either. Please, go on. Sorry.
Gary, you were saying?
I was done.
Okay. Oh. No, I thought I would play either. I got into Frederick first, obviously, because it was out first. I think that my favorite line about it is, no game will make you more attentive in counting to three because of how that plays out in the mechanics. But if you want to see how wargaming aesthetics, maps, soldiers, flags, troops moving soldiers around, run square into Euro dynamics or Euro mechanics, it's right there. Yeah. And it's all in a very, and it is, I don't know what it is. The combat system uses playing cards that are quite lovely. And there's something about staring at your opponent and slapping down a card and going, 7. Oh yeah, 8. Oh yeah, 9. And deciding whether you're going to spend your resources. And it's got that lovely dynamic of, do I commit? Do I pull back? I know other games have used it, but in the context of a war game like Frederick, it's brilliant. Dead brilliant. Get it?
I know it's not an exact parallel, but as you were counting out the cards there, in the back of my head, I'm just picturing duck season, rabbit season.
that's what it is. That's what it is. It's like, oh yeah? Oh yeah? I don't lose. You lose. No, you lose.
Liz, what did we not get to yet on your list? Have we gotten through the ones you had prepped for this?
I just kind of tossed a couple on here that I think are worth trying. I don't know if they're canon, but if you ever get a shot at playing Republic of Rome, you should. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, I agree with that too. That's a cool game.
Ding, ding.
That is a cool game.
It's awesome. I just think that it's really special. I'm kind of gunning to play it after we finish up Virgin Queen with the group that I'm playing with, because you can do it on Vassal. And yeah, I just want more games with those vibes.
All right. What else you got? Anything else on the list there?
Me? I'm set. You. This is canon, not just everything. There's a lot of good stuff out there.
No, that's fine. I was talking about the sort of the list you had prepped for the canon here.
Yeah, we pretty much hit it.
Yeah. Jim, have we gotten to all of yours, or is there anything we left off that we're missing somewhere?
Well, I realize it's not supposed to be the game you love the most, but I can't let a list like this go and not mention Napoleon's Last Battles.
Ah, that was one of my ones that are still left.
There you go. Go play it. It is of the classic SPI era. It is, as I've said on multiple occasions, it is my favorite board game. I will play it anytime, anywhere, with anyone. I don't care. And I can teach the rules in well less than 15 minutes.
And you don't need them in front of you to do it.
No, I don't. I seriously don't. So please, go out there and check it out. It is Kevin Zucker. He has done glorious, lovely games since, and you make jokes about him, and deservedly so, because I am an obsessive. Gary, you have done him great honor. I watched enough of your show to know how many of them you have. So it's you do him great.
But I got damn close to all of them.
I seem so. It's and salute to you for that. I think I'm short one for some reason. I think I lent it out like some kind of an idiot.
I'm missing a couple of the campaigns of Napoleon just because some of them are hard to get. But of course, because Bonaparte in Italy is really hard to get, and I got a copy. Kevin's redoing it.
Yeah,
thanks, Kevin. Thanks.
That came up. Grant Lindberg so actually had that. That's the one he had when we did Pushing Cardboard.
I got the big. Are we talking about the big one with the three maps?
Oh, you got the big one. Oh, God. Yeah. I thought you were playing that. Okay. Yeah.
Now I have that too. But yeah. No, I mean the big boy.
Nice. Yeah, that is nice. That is very pretty. That is most pretty. So yeah, that would be one. Would definitely be Napoleon's Last Battles. It's obviously the story of the 100 days that allows you to do Lagny, Quatre Bras, Waterloo, and all that stuff. Gary did hit Wooden Ships and Iron Men. Thumbs up for that. That was the second one. And the only other one that I looked at, I circled it, and then I uncircled it, and then I looked at it again. I confess I was debating whether or not to put it on, and I said, what the heck, I will put it on just because I like it. I think you gotta play Ogre. We haven't had a lot of science fiction games.
Yeah, I was gonna bring that up.
I would say Starfleet Battles, but that seems like
that's a lot to swallow, man.
That's it.
People to stay in wargaming?
I couldn't do it. Whereas Ogre, and it's, you know, yes, it's got this now metastasized form that, you know, doesn't fit into a gym. But Ogre in its original form fits on what house size is that map? It's not even 8.5 by 11, is it?
The original map's a little bigger. The original game, you could play the whole thing on a cookie sheet.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to say the original map in the little pocket size version is 11 by 17. That's my recollection. And that's the version, and the only version of Ogre that I have actually played.
Yeah. And that's all I okay, you know what, internet? You're okay. Tonight you can stay. The original Ogre map from the 1977 Metagaming Edition was 14 by 9.
That's a whack noodle size right there.
Yeah. Why Steve chose that size? This is Steve Jackson as a game almost as thought experiment. It has become so much more. But this is to me, it's a number of things. First of all, it's a great game in its own right. It's very simple. The big powerful against the weak many. So it's fascinating at that level. But it also speaks to how you can use a game like this to imagine a future. It would be easy for me to say something like Starship Troopers, a game I love, and things like that. But really, I would say, look, let's play this game. Let's play this Ogre so you can meet this science fiction space and realize so much else has come from it.
Are you talking about the Avalon Hill Starship Troopers?
Yes, of course. Yes.
Yeah, my problem with that is that it's space infantry, but it's not Starship Troopers. Right, it bears a passing resemblance to the Starship Troopers board game from Avalon Hill has as much tie-in with the book as the movie did.
Oh, I don't think that's fair.
I don't think that's fair either. There are skinnies in the game.
Yeah,
there are skinnies in the game. There are tunnels in the game.
Yes,
but there's you could reskin that Starship Troopers board game to a vast number of other sci-fi off-planet IPs and it still works.
You could reskin Waterloo, your recent Skolengrad CRT, and call it Waterloo. They did that. What's your point?
you could reskin Battlecry as everything.
That just because we can doesn't mean we should.
No, and well, the idea that it's, you know, that it's not a close tie in to the novel, sure, I'll stipulate, but I think it is certainly better than the movie by a country mile. Borrowing an old guy analogy,
I'll actually stick up for the movie.
You just dug a hole in the ground to put the bar in.
I think the movie is a pretty well done satire of the book.
It's a hoot, but I'm just not sure. We're way off topic at this point.
Way.
Are there any games that any of the three of y'all had on your list that we hadn't mentioned yet?
Yes. All Russian right. Campaign.
The Russian Campaign.
Which edition?
Yeah, I was about to say.
I'd say the Avalon Hill edition.
Really?
There's a million editions of this game, right? There's, you know, even if we just say Russian Campaign, and leave out all the other games that are answers to Russian Campaign, like Russia Besieged from Compass and Russian Front from Avalon Hill. They tried to strike lightning in a bottle twice, and some people prefer Russian Front, but I don't. So, but I think it's a classic game. It will show you a mechanic that was popular for a while and still pops up from time to time, mandatory attacks. And I think it's a better game than the other game that famously includes Sokov attacks, Anzio, which I don't like.
Well, Anzio, I think you're a lot more constrained in how you try to maneuver around those Sokov and mandatory. Like, you're pushed together a lot more in Anzio just by the limitations of the terrain, whereas out there in the vast plains of Russia, you've got plenty of room to maneuver to try and set up the most advantageous thing you can with the fewest Sokovs. whereas Anzio, you're sort of, you know, you're up against the beach. There's only so much.
Yeah, you've got a lot more flexibility in Russian campaign. Now, yeah. Not that, you know, Russian campaign or Third Reich or anything that I mentioned doesn't have its share of problems, but that wasn't the topic, was it?
No. Absolutely. So the reason I wanted to so just looking through the list, and I've been for first time ever on the podcast here, I've actually been writing down the games as we've been mentioning them so that I can, you know, pull the list of games to include in the episode here with the links to stuff. But it also lets me go back and look at some of the things that weren't mentioned that some of the audience may be wondering, you know, well, what the heck? Well, what about X, Y, or Z? The first thing that jumps off the page to me is to some folks, they're going to scratch their head and go, huh? But I think to those of us of a certain vintage, none of the Milton Bradley Battlemaster series is on here. There's
mine was because Axis and Allies is yet another answer to Third Reich.
Nice. Good one.
Fair. But, got him. But that's not the only one of that series.
Oh, by no means. And really, Axis and Allies isn't all that similar to the other ones in the series, right?
Yeah. But it's just because that was such if we go round up 100 Wargamers that you know, somewhere north of 40, I bet 50 of them started with one of the Battlemaster series. That was the
entry. And I bet 49 of them started with Axis and Allies.
Probably, but I mean, that was just such a foundational place where so many folks started. It's just interesting that none of them are on the list. Your point is valid that they are sort of a reaction to Third Reich, and you never get Axis and Allies without Third Reich. Like, that's...
Well, plus, you invited me and Jim on the show, Brant.
This is true.
So, you...
If I
this is literally what you asked for.
All five of the Battlemaster series on here, so I get that.
I just to be clear, I still own them all. Broadsides and Boarding Parties is my favorite.
That's an interesting choice. My favorite was Shogun, actually.
I love Shogun. I like them all. I just think that they're all, with the exception of Broadsides and Boarding Parties, which is a totally different animal, they're all Risk.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah.
That's,
kind of. Shogun is 100% Risk on a map of Japan.
Yeah. No, it's a fair point. There was only one air game mentioned and none of them put on the lists. There's no aviation games here. There's an aerial component to some of these games in that, like, Third Reich's got strategic bombing and the Empire of the Sun's got air forces floating around in it, but there's no aerial game in here anywhere.
What?
If you want Dawn Patrol, play it. It's interesting.
Yeah.
I brought up
Liz, you mentioned RAF Battle of Britain in the Butterfield list.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, she did mention it in the Butterfield list. But that's what I'm saying. Like, it wasn't go play this one. It was play one of the Butterfield games.
I also mentioned that you should look at things like B7. The problem is a lot of solo aerial games are falling in a choose your adventure, but truly RAF, and I did not dig in on it because I do often, but I still think Thunderbolt Apache Leader is great.
Yeah,
but
speaking of foundational games, I mean, Ricky's War and Luftwaffe from Avalon Hill, those got played to death. That's why it's so hard to find copies in good condition that are not missing pieces or sat upon, because they got played to death.
Yeah. Well, or a Luftwaffe game that didn't get chucked out a window at some point because it's just...
Or hell, Air Force.
Yeah. On the other hand, it's very easy to find very lightly played copies of Air War. So,
that's actually true. I tend to see those in very nice condition.
Yeah, because nobody made it past, like, you know, the first half of the first turn, and they went, this sucks. And they just, like, you know, I'm not being graded on this. Why am I doing calculus for fun? So they just moved on. There's not a lot of Ancients games on the list. There's a couple things here and there, but the vast majority of this of the list are Gunpowder and later. And even the Ancients are, by and large, you know, if Ancients is your preferred flavor of this type of game, like an older coin game or, you know, CNC Ancients or something, but other than Republic of Rome, like, there ain't a lot of ancient anything in here.
I had a candidate for Ancients. I thought about something about Out of Great Battles of History, but I kind of wanted to stay away from games and big series, because then comes to which game, right? I could have picked I certainly could have picked an OCS game, but which OCS game, right? You mean Smolensk, the one I usually recommend to people that runs like $300 now on the secondary market? That's a great choice. Yeah, go play that.
Well,
yeah,
but
good luck,
I mean, Great Battles Alexander is a blast. So
it's a really good game. It's a really solid game. But I mean, all of those big compendiums are Julius Caesar and SBQR are too.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned OCS. There are a couple of very popular series that were mentioned, but usually mentioned as, yeah, I didn't want to put that on there. So you, Gary, you mentioned both Europa and OCS.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but there's also the M&P Civil War series. That
Line of Battle?
Well,
or do you mean the Civil War Brigade Battles series?
Is M&P Great Battles or is M&P Great Campaigns?
Great Campaigns is M&P. Great Battles is GMT.
GMT, yeah. I don't do Civil War, so I get those backwards all the time. But neither one of those series were mentioned. The Simonich 40X series was not mentioned. So there were a bunch of different series of games out there that weren't even mentioned. And the two others that kind of were, OCS and Europa, were Gary kind of discarding them. So there are a bunch of different series out there that we didn't touch on. You know, we mentioned the block games, the coin series, the States of Siege games. The other thing that I know I'm about to start a fist fight on this, but nobody mentioned Twilight Struggle.
I thought about it.
So
I mean, let's face it, you know, a lot of folks have played Twilight Struggle.
Yeah. And I think it comes back to whether you love it or hate it, at least once somewhere out there, it's probably one to try. Another one that is a hugely popular series that was not mentioned was Combat Commander.
You should have told me this was going to be a 4-hour show, Brant, and I would have come with a longer list.
Yeah, I was going to keep it tight. And honestly, like, I know that we're talking about a canon, but I guess I wanted to pick things that weren't, like, I feel like Twilight Struggle is almost so obvious that I didn't undertake to mention it.
That's why I didn't put it, I actually write it down either.
Like, to me, it's a matter of, like, you know.
Everybody knows about Twilight Struggle already.
Well, but I think.
I guess it's like, if you're talking about canon, I mean, I guess everybody knows about the Gospels already, too, so.
Well, but here's the case I would make against putting Twilight Struggle on there is, if we're talking about the wargaming canon, there's significant disagreement as to whether or not Twilight Struggle is a wargame.
That's the third show we're all signing up for. Absolutely the F not.
So I'm not trying to start the argument about is it or isn't it. I'm simply pointing out that there is a significant part of the wargaming population for whom having not played it is a badge of honor.
Although, here's what I'll say. First of all,
I think that's weird.
No, wait. One, if you're like, I've never watched Star Wars, that doesn't make you cool. Shut up.
Right.
But two, I actually think that it makes it more important to play something like Twilight Struggle. Like, if you're going to argue about what isn't a war game and what isn't foundational, how can you talk about something you've never played?
Agreed. I'm simply noting that nobody brought it up. There was also there.
Are you scolding us for not bringing up Twilight Struggle, Brant?
Take it how you want.
Okay. I'm offended.
My conscience is clear.
I am angered now.
Very few naval games. Not zero, but very few. Although Wooden Ships and Iron Men is a gotta-have-it kind of choice. There's not a lot of naval stuff in here. And it wasn't until the very end that a sci-fi one came up at all with Ogre. And there are no fantasy war games in here.
Really, I honestly feel like, you know, we may have a different conversation in 30 years, but I mean, is there one other than Divine Right that you could consider foundational in a similar sense to a lot of the games that we talked about? I couldn't think of one.
No.
I also want to point out that, like, even just talking about, like, what this is a. Not the kind of conversation you could fit into 4 hours or even maybe a year. Like, there's just so much out there. There's so much that has been, and there's so much that's been important to somebody. Like, you can vetch about all the things that didn't get mentioned, but we had an hour and a half on a random Tuesday night.
Oh,
like,
I know.
This is shit.
You get him. You get him, Liz. Get him.
We're not even up to an hour and a half yet. Like, but
go spider monkey on him. Do it.
No, Gary's point is valid, though, is that, you know, if you were going to mention a fantasy one, which one would it be? Divine Right is the no shit sort of choice, but there were other ones published by some major publishers out there.
Avalon Hill had a dozen of them.
Yes, yeah, no.
Well, and SBI,
and I can't name any of them. And
yeah, I mean, I are you seriously telling me you wanted Magic Realm on this list?
No.
Okay.
But,
well,
play stupid games, win stupid prizes, Brant.
Yeah, come on, man.
Definitely not. I'm simply looking over the list and noting where there are gaps in the combination of types of games, the genres that they cover, the types of warfare in some cases. Again, you know, naval combat isn't that weird of a topic out there, but we've really only got one primary, you know, one naval focused game, and that's Wooden Ships and Iron Men.
I chose Wooden Ships and Iron Men over Flat Top, which I adore, because I think it's more approachable.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, and this isn't a criticism of, damn it, this other thing should have been on the list. This is noting that we've got four folks here with a variety of wargaming experiences, and if we're starting to talk about what's kind of the center mass almost of the kinds of experiences that you would want wargamers to have across the breadth of the hobby, we've got some gaps in the genres and eras out there that in this list. And it's not saying that, oh my God, we've got to fill every possible niche, because I don't think that's really the case.
I didn't try to do that, that's for sure.
Yeah, but I do find it interesting that within the things that we did come up with, and look, man, there's not a lot of people out there that are going to say that, nah, fuck it, skip squad leader. Nah, you don't need to play Third Reich at some point in your life. Nah, you can blow that off altogether. Nah, Kriegsspiel, who needs it? Forget that crap. Like, there's nobody's out there making that argument, I would think. I'm sure we can all find that one contrarian who's going to say, no, no, forget that.
It's not as though knuckleheads are particularly hard to find.
God, no, not in this hobby. Not in this hobby, and yeah, not on the internet.
So when you start,
right.
Yeah, when you turn our people loose on the, but you know, again, just looking back over the list of what is and isn't here, you know, again, not a lot of sci-fi stuff on the list. We've got Ogre on there, but not, you know, Freedom of the Galaxy, not any of the old SPI ones that, you know, were around forever. No, not any more recent ones. Certainly not any IP tied games coming out of the, you know, the Star Wars, Star Trek, whatever different IPs that are tied in, unless you count the brand new Battle of Hoth one as the Commands and Colors, you know, as one of the Commands and Colors ones that you would consider.
The only Battle of Hoth game I recognize is the one released by West End Games in 1988.
Yeah, which is a much better game.
But I'm just, you know,
and again, I still wouldn't put that on this list.
No, yeah. I wouldn't either.
No,
we are also not explicitly talking about favorite games. I mean, if we were, oh. I would have given you Outreach.
Oh, absolutely. Again, it's not trying to make the case that we should have filled all of those holes.
You're trying to make the case that we need a part two.
I'm simply trying to identify that there are in fact holes around what a lot of folks would consider canon. What is, and it's a different conversation if we're saying what are the canonical war games, and there happens to be a sci-fi game or at most two on here, versus what are the canonical sci-fi war games. That's a whole different conversation, right? I mean, yes. And that's all we're talking about.
And I have to tell you, and I think Liz will sympathize with this, I am uncomfortable with the term canon here. I tend to frame this kind of question, which I have done a show about, as essential war games that I think all war gamers would benefit from or learn something from or gain some valuable experience or insight by playing, even if they happen to be 40 or 50 or sometimes even 60 years old.
Actually, yeah. I think that the word canon makes it feel like it should be old. Does that make sense? Yes. Like, there's something about it that I think gives you an unconscious age bias.
Yeah.
I think the word canon is funny until I think about how annoying arguments are about, I mean, you can think about the biblical canon, but even the canon of, like, a literature degree. Mm-hmm. Like, what is a great books program supposed to include? Like, we could argue about that forever. I think it's just,
Liz, it was your term.
Yeah, but like, I didn't expect to have to sit here and talk to you for an hour and a half about it. Let me have my throwaway remarks.
You should know, man. I can take any conversation and turn it into a podcast. That's not a problem.
I tease. No, actually, what I enjoy talking about this topic for is thinking about, like, I think that if we thought about it more regularly, it would reveal a lot about, like, our underpinnings when it comes to, like, what is a war game and what is this and what is that. A lot of it comes down to what games do you think are essential for this branch of the hobby. And so for me, like, I'll say you should play a PAX game, because to me, something like PAX Renaissance, while I don't think people count it as, quote, a war game, in terms of historical expression, is really interesting. Or something like Republic of Rome, which is not, I mean, it's I think there are people who would argue about what it is, but it's trying to express something. And so for me, like, you can tell that that's what my interest is and how I define or decide what to care about, but your choices always say something about you.
The way you're characterizing PAX Renaissance comes into sort of the last question that I wanted to throw at everybody, and this wasn't something that I asked y'all to prepare any answers for, but is there a game that is one that you particularly love and think folks probably ought to try at some point in their life, but doesn't necessarily belong on this list of, you know, oh my God, you know, these are the ones that you should check off as many as possible to claim your, you know, to truly earn your Grognard merit badge, right? We've got, I don't know, probably about 30-ish games that were mentioned here, or, you know, exemplars of a series like Cuba Libre for the coin series, but tag in a different coin game if you've got a different area of interest. So we've got 25 to 30 of them total here on this list. Is there something that's one of those, you know, personally, I think you should really check one of these out, even if I'm not willing to put it in the overall canon of these are the things you got to have tried to really be a war gamer. And so, Liz, I don't know if that's exactly what you were going for with PAX Renaissance, but that's kind of what it sounded like to me.
For me, this is more about categories. Although I do think that if you want to look at games of history, you do have to look at John Company's second edition.
Okay.
Because I think that if you ignore something that's got that much historical expression in it with some war, then you do that at your peril. I think that it does boil down to where I started in this conversation, which is there are kind of series or genres of war game that you should try. It's just like a mainstream hobby thing. You should try a worker placement. You should try a deck builder. You should try, you know what I mean? I feel like wargaming is like that, and that you should try things like in the different series and sample until you find love.
All right. Fair enough. Jim, Gary, either one of y'all want to grab the mic and run with this?
I got to get all mine out, plus a couple other ones that I didn't actually write down. So I think I've covered it. Like I said, maybe we need a part two.
Yeah, well, and it's in your case, I was thinking maybe like one of the Labatt games or an OCS game. Like it's something that you might want to have tried at some point just for that experience of it all, but you're not quite willing to go far enough to put it on a list like this.
Well, I mean, I would say the same thing I think I already said, was I kind of avoided series games on this for this conversation, because I don't think very many of them are quote unquote canonical, whatever that means in the context of war games. And you run the chance, you know, it's only me saying OCS is the start of a conversation about OCS and what the different OCS games are like and which ones are good for newcomers and which ones are good for people who played a lot of OCS. So I intentionally avoided that. None of the things on my list were series games.
Yeah. Well, plus we did that OCS podcast last season.
Yeah.
We've already done that one. That one we don't have to schedule in the future. We've already done it. Yeah, Jim, what about you?
Well, Liz took my primary one, which would have been John Company 2, because we are friends.
We agree on something?
Oh. Yeah, I know. And you know what you can't do with John Company is play it solo.
Actually, that's a lie. Ricky Royale has a solo mode.
Oh, God. Why?
Hold on. The key is it's a mod, right? It's like putting a spoiler on your station wagon. You can do it.
I actually do prefer to play it in company, because guess what? Some of us have, some of us contain multitudes, and other of us are, you just one track. You
know? Yeah, we can. one track, many, many, many branches. No, it's John Company, as we are all, of course, friends of Cole Worley on this show. His learning shows up in that game. If you think it's not a war game, I encourage you to play it. That's all I'm saying. You're going to feel like you've been in a war. It is brutal and ugly and lovely, and the message it conveys is so good. I don't agree with it. I actually disagree with a lot of it, but that's okay, because when, you know, a argument with which you disagree, historically speaking, when that brilliantly made is time incredibly well spent. And I have both editions, so you should definitely go out and pick that up and play it. I think on the I would be remiss if I didn't mention something else on the Napoleonic side, and I think the game that I would put out there for folks is is probably one of the later, yeah, I'm going to say it, one of the later Zucker games in the campaign. Not necessarily the campaigns, the Library of Napoleonic Battles. And I certainly respect what Gary was saying about not picking a series. So I'll just say The Last Success. It's one of my favorite campaigns. And it's such a lovely game, and just go out and do it. It's good for you.
Great battles in The Last Success, too.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
The one that I was thinking of personally that I think folks should give it a try just for the experience of it, but wasn't willing to take the plunge and throw it on this list, is City Fight.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The idea of the kind of fog of war that you can put into a two-player game that's not truly double blind, that's not separate maps, is pretty inspiring in the way they were able to do it with City Fight. And that is one that I think is a really neat experience that if you get the chance to do it, you should take it. But I wasn't willing to like take that full on step of, you know, let's nominate it for sainthood kind of a thing. I wasn't willing to quite go that far, but I do think it's up there in the quasi historical, but not truly a war game category. The other one I would throw out there, Jacinto's Mythology had a whole lot going on in it. And it's a bit of a tangled mess. If somebody were to revise and update that one today with some slightly cleaner mechanics and the 40 years that we've learned about how to write rule books, I think there's an incredible all-timer hit of a game hiding in there somewhere. I think that one definitely deserves a relook. But even as it was originally constructed, I think it's a really nifty game that is way too often overlooked, but a cleanup would almost, in my mind, put it pretty close to a list like this.
Who's go?
Anyhow, we're now around the 90-minute mark, although, again, a little bit of editing and, like, taking me saying, out of here a bunch. We'll get it down to, like, an hour and 20 or so, maybe shorter. Thank you guys. This was kind of cool. I'm happy that we were able to get through it with a minimal amount of profanity directed at each other, which I was fully prepared to.
Oh no, only you. I like everyone else here.
Yeah, me too. Agree.
No, it was awesome to get to hang out with y'all.
Liz at no point tried to judge us. I think that's key.
Oh, I think she absolutely did. I just think she's, you know, in a slightly weakened state at the moment, and so it didn't fully come out.
Well, in fairness, we were all judging Brant.
Yes. Yes.
He put himself up on the block for judgment.
Mm-hmm. I was about to say, how's that different from any other podcast we do?
I didn't say it was different or new.
Yeah, just that it was happening.
Right. Again.
It's sort of an implied task at this point. Right? It's just understood. Cool. So, audience, coming up over the rest of this season, last season we took some time to dig into a bunch of different series of games. This season we're actually lining up conversations with a bunch of different designers. And so that's something that we're going to lean into a little bit. Again, in the fall, we've always got our wrap-up of the solo game survey that we will be doing here in a couple of weeks. We've also got some conversations around conventions. So we are going to have the episode following the fall assembly, but we're also going to have kind of that consolidated episode that we do after the big blammo weekend where SD Hist and Compass and Foxconn all happen on the same weekend. So we're going to get some guests from those. Gary, you're not going to COVID. CovidCon this year, are you?
No, I have already said no to the fella I usually go with.
All right, so we'll have to, you know, Liz is doing SD Hist. Maybe we'll drag her back for an SD Hist conversation. We'll see.
Yeah.
But we're going to get folks that have been to each of those different conventions and have some conversations around those. And so you're going to have some of the usual things that we do, as well as, you know, having some conversations with some different designers. For tonight's episode, if you've got some things that you think belong in that wargaming canon that we didn't mention, pop into the comments down below or jump in the forums or just yell at us wherever on social media, like we're used to it. It happens all the time. Just make sure you tag either Liz or Jim or Gary, whoever you're actually disagreeing with, because it won't be me, because all my picks were perfect. So, you know, tag whoever it is that you're mad at and make sure that they get to see it also, so y'all can yell at each other. And guys, thank y'all very much. I know this was a little bit of a weirder conversation, but I'm glad we had it. And I think it's a pretty interesting list to put up there and let folks take a look at and ponder and muse over and yell at each other about, whatever. So, Gary, missed you last night. Would have enjoyed a counterclipping show to heckle you from the comments, but
me too.
As always, folks, Monday night, you've got Gary's counterclipping show. Jim is on. Are you guys up to four nights a week? You're still just on three.
We are pretty much three every now and then, because our good friend Michael Hopper is getting ready to release more of his exciting Napoleonic miniature wargame scenario books. We've been doing some play testing for him, so we fire up the Friday night Falderall in the playtest pen, but usually three.
Yeah, so Wednesday, Thursday, Saturday. Saturday night fights, of course, we also post to the Dragoon site, but Jim is live multiple times a week, pop in the comments, heckle, and you know, make fun of, and chat with your fellow observers. And then, Liz, podcast goes out to the public on Mondays. But Patreon supporters get it on Saturday, right?
Yeah. I try to put things out about 48 hours in advance of anything I put out. And the podcast airs on Mondays. I try to air something else on Thursday or Friday. If you're following me on Patreon, you'll get it early. Even if you're a free Patreon member, I've also been starting to like put up more like design diaries and stuff. I just got permission to put up some Queen of Spies early art, so I might do that this week. So yeah, Beyond Solitaire is up to stuff all the time.
And you'll see Mention and Dispatches episodes over the next dozen or so Fridays as we get through the fall before we take our holiday hiatus. So, audience, thank you very much. And panel, thank you very much. And StreamYard, thank you very much for recording all this for us without kicking anybody out after we hit record, which is nice. We will catch everybody next time on another episode of Mention and Dispatches.